Morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. It is Monday morning. My dad will be calling in to tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We've got some crazy food-related topics that we're going to talk about. And it is Monday, which means it's time for the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. Colin Suter and Eric Childress join me each Monday morning from eFilmCritic.com, RogerEbert.com, and more. And we talk about the movies. We review the new movies. And then Eric sticks around, and we talk about the box office, which we will also do. So without further ado, let's welcome the guys to the show. Here's Eric. Hey, Eric.
Hello.
And Colin. Hey, Colin.
Hello there.
All right. How's it going?
Okay.
All right. Okay. So, since last we spoke, the Cubs won the World Series.
They did, didn't they?
Yeah, they did.
Yeah. I didn't know.
I still, you didn't hear about it, Colin?
No, I'm very happy. That's good to know.
Yeah. I still can't wrap my mind around it, Eric. I just,
You know, it's going to be weird when we get to a point where we normalize it.
Yeah. I mean, I can't. So, did either of you guys see him on SNL?
Yes. Yeah.
I got to tell you, I thought the stripper thing was funny. I thought it was funny.
I hated that sketch.
Yeah.
I thought A.D. Bryant kind of ruined the setup of that sketch by not being able to play dead convincingly.
Uh-huh.
So the whole tenor of the sketch I thought was off. I did love the Weekend Update stuff.
Oh, it was great. It was also
reveal of the fourth Cub.
Yeah, it was also just the fact that Bill Murray was back, you know, mm-hmm. you know, on the set and everything. That was just it added to the greatness of the moment, you know.
Yes.
So yeah, it was pretty cool, and they just looked so happy.
Yeah, I know.
You know, like all three of them. Dexter Fowler just had a smile on. He had a grin on his face the entire time he was out.
Yes,
there.
He did.
And you know, good for him. So anyway, it was a good week sports wise.
Yeah, pretty. So wait till next year.
Yeah. Wait. It was a good. And not only that, the Hawks are on a tear too. They've won six straight. So
wow.
Yeah, they won six.
And all the hubbub. I've forgotten about all the other.
Yeah, I was able to like. I remember specifically Thursday going, okay, now I can completely concentrate on the Hawks.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, they've won six straight. We'll have a Blackhawks Express later this morning as well. Okay, well, let's get to the new movies. Colin, why don't you tell us about Tower?
All right. This is a documentary by Keith Maitland, and it's about the sniper shootings that took place at the University of Texas Tower in the mid-60s. You know, it was a peaceful day in the University of Texas campus when suddenly a man at the top of the, you know, U of Texas Tower started shooting people seemingly at random. And it's a documentary that utilizes testimonials from people who were there recounting the experience. But it does so in a unique way in that it also uses reenactments and actual footage, but also with the use of rotoscoping animation and testimonials reenacted by younger actors, the same ones reenacting the events that are being animated, if that makes sense. These actors are not only reenacting, you know, what happened, but they're reenacting the testimonials given by the regular people. But then the movie shifts later on and you see the real people talking about the experience, and they're not animated. So it's a really unique way of presenting a film. We've seen reenactments before. We've seen, you know, that those kind of testimonials before, obviously, but never done quite like this. The animation, like I said, it's rotoscoping, so it's got that kind of waking life feel to it. Not quite as trippy, but you know, you could tell that they went out and shot some footage and animated over it. And the result is a very unique experience at first, and then once it shifts gears about halfway through, and we start to see the real people, we start to get a grasp on why they chose to do it this way. It's a really fascinating way of you know, recording history and then reenacting history and re-recording history with, you know, having the people who were there, who were shot at, who were, you know, helping out, you know, who were, you know, cops who are on the scene, you know, sort of hearing their perspective and with a younger voice, is I think a really bold and interesting choice, for, you know, what could have been a very straightforward documentary. So this one's kind of all about the presentation of it. And I thought the presentation was a really fascinating alternative to, you know, the usual, while also giving us a very nice, potent message at the end that makes this, you know, this event, this very bizarre, tragic event, you know, relevant to today. So this is a really, you know, I think a really fascinating 82-minute film that, you know, found a way to do something different with, you know, a typical documentary narrative. So definitely recommended.
Okay. Eric, what about you?
Yeah, I think this is actually a pretty extraordinary work of art. For all the reasons that Colin said, you know, it seems like possibly a weird choice to present this in sort of the animated way that they do, animated just in style, not in to use as an adjective, when Colin says, you know, the movie makes this shift about halfway through as we start to move a little bit away from the animation, as you know, the events of the storytelling almost play out almost in real time to an extent. I mean, the actual event took like some like 96 minutes, and the movie's only 82. But we actually see all the different points of views of people that were there, people that, you know, stood behind this pillar or who were right in the front lines, and people who watched other people die just because they couldn't get to them in time, pregnant people. And then, you know, it shifts to the cops and, you know, things that, you know, so we get a perspective on the, you know, the tactics involved in bringing this person down. But when it does make that shift and we start to actually see some of the people that were there on that day, this movie becomes incredibly moving and really heartbreaking. And, you know, you talk about this sort of the relevance to today. I mean, this is still kind of a sort of a uniquely legendary chapter in, you know, American criminal history. But today it's, you know, we almost don't think twice sometimes because it seems like these things happen so often. I actually got to see this movie right around the time that there was an incident in Dallas where cops were being taken down by a sniper. And so it was right on my mind as this was happening. And I think that the presentation of this is really just fantastic up and down. I think this is absolutely one of the very best documentaries of the year.
Okay. Wow. I've not seen it. It's at the Music Box, by the way, for people who are looking to check it out. It's called Tower. What was the name of the Chicago 7 documentary that was animated? Do you guys remember?
I think it was just Chicago 8, right?
Was it?
Yeah, I think so. I think it was something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Because that was the only, you know, that popped into my mind immediately when you guys started talking about mm-hmm. this, but
it's becoming kind of a normal thing, not normal, but it's becoming kind of a trendy kind of thing. I don't mean trendy in a bad way, but like, you know, we played a documentary at our film festival called Nuts. That was a documentary I think almost all animated, or if not, yeah, I think it was all animated. Yeah.
That's an interesting route to take. But I remember the Chicago trial thing being one of the first to do that, right? Because I remember that being very unusual.
Yeah, and there's that actually, if I'm not mistaken, I believe that opened the Sundance Film Festival that year.
Yeah.
I was probably, you know, to make a list of all the documentaries that have utilized animation. But, I think it's a very unique way to tell the story.
Okay. All right,
Chicago 10 is what it was called.
Oh, it's Chicago 10. Okay, it was called Chicago 10. All right. This is a movie called Tower, and both Colin and Eric highly recommend it. It's playing at the Music Box if you would like to check it out. Okay, guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yep.
Eric and Colin are going to hang out, and we're going to take a break for the news. When we come back from the news, we've got all the new movies to review, and we will talk box office as well. It's Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studios, 7th floor of the Trib Tower, and here till 5 o'clock. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5, and Steve Cochran at 6. So stick around for all of that. My dad will be calling in to tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we will also be talking about some weird food. We got some crazy food topics that we're going to get to, that some of which we've had for a little while, but we're going to jump into the world of food. We've got a Blackhawks Express also, and we are here. And you can text or talk at 312-981-7200. You can check us out on Twitter at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is our Facebook page, facebook.com/Nick D Show. Every Monday morning, we review the movies. Eric Childress, Colin Suter join me, and we're doing that right now. And here is Eric. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
And Colin. Hey, Colin.
Hello.
All right, so you guys did not see Trolls.
Nope.
Okay, I did. all right, well, I'll tell you about Trolls. Trolls is based on, I guess, those little troll dolls. right? That's what they're
sure.
It's like the little troll dolls that people buy and have for like good luck charms, and they've
either that or South Park.
And so they made an animated movie out of it with some major star power involved as well. Let's see. So do you guys know, is there a story behind these toys? Do they have like a background, or did they just make it up for this movie?
I don't know of any story.
Okay, well, then I guess they made it up for the movie. Anyway, what happens is there's a troll village, a bunch of trolls. They live in a troll tree, and they're in the middle of this town that is run by creatures called Bergens. And they're the only – they're sort of like – they're trollish too, but they're just like – they're ogres. They're more like ogres. So they're like – and they're miserable all the time. And the only time that they can achieve happiness – the only time that they can achieve happiness is to eat a troll. When you eat a troll, according to the Bergens, you become happy. So there's a troll tree in the middle of this town run by the Bergens, and the trolls escape because they're tired of being eaten. So they're led by the king, voiced by John Cleese, amazingly. And so all the trolls leave. They've been gone for 20 years. They've escaped. And so the Bergens have been looking for them. They live in another area. And all they are, you know, like Anna Kendrick plays Poppy. She's like the lead, you know, the princess troll. And she's all the trolls, all they do is dance, and all they do is sing and hug. And they're always happy, except for one. There's one troll named Branch, voiced by Justin Timberlake, who's just miserable and doesn't like dancing and lives in a bunker and is terrified that the Bergens are going to find them. And the Bergens do find them in the form of a chef, voiced by Christine Baranski. She's the chef who cooks up the trolls for people to eat, for the Bergens to eat. She discovers the trolls and goes back to Bergentown or Bergenville or whatever the hell it's called, and says, "Hey, there's trolls out there. You know, we can go and get them, and we can bring back Trollstice," is what they call it. Trollstice is what they call the ceremony, the day of the ceremony when you eat trolls. So that's the basic thing, and then they have to. You know, so Poppy and Branch get together and go on an adventure across, you know, the land, this weird little land, to retrieve their friends who have been kidnapped, their troll friends who have been kidnapped and brought to the Bergens. Meanwhile, there's a subplot involving a female Bergen who is a nurse. She's just a maid. And she cleans up the kitchen and stuff. And there's a romance between her and the king, the new king of the Bergens, which is voiced by Christopher Mintz Plasse, and Bridget, this other voice, is voiced by Zooey Deschanel. So there's a lot of star power in this movie, and there are a lot of it's from the people who, you know, from the company that brought you the Minions, and I think, right, it's DreamWorks, right?
No, they don't do, but they didn't do.
They didn't do Minions.
It's not Illumination, right?
No. It's the Shrek people.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So anyway, all right. So that's the basic plot. Now, it's your standard sort of, you know, newly animated movie. You know, some of the voice work here is pretty great. I think Anna Kendrick in particular is wonderful, and so is Justin Timberlake. And some of the other choices are interesting. It's not, you know, this is obviously not going to break any records. It's not doing anything new. It's your standard good versus evil romance, you know, like I'm a grumpy guy now, I'm not going to be a grumpy guy. And it's got some laughs in it. It's very, very colorful. And I will say this, what sets this apart is the music. There's a lot of great music in this movie. Justin Timberlake is the musical. He was the executive producer of all the music. And they've got, you know, a couple of new songs in there and then some older songs. And they're all sung by the cast. And there's just something really, I don't know, there's something really kind of sweet and wonderful hearing Justin Timberlake sing and Anna Kendrick sing True Colors, which is like one of my favorite songs. So it's like it was really nice to hear that. Justin Timberlake covers September by Earth, Wind, and Fire. And so the music's great. And anytime it breaks out into song, it's a lot of fun to watch. And, you know, and Anna Kendrick can sing her ass off, as we all know. And just hearing the two of them singing is fun. It's not very great. It's not very good. But it's fun. The kids seem to enjoy it. There were a few laughs, but what's, like I said, what set it apart is the music. There's a really terrific soundtrack to this movie that uses a lot of really great songs, and they're used well in the movie. And it's a there's no question about it. It's a very happy film. Like when it's over, you feel good, you know. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know what I mean? In this day and age, it's nice to just go to a movie and just have some fun. And that's all this is. It's I'm recommending it. You know, it's not breaking any new ground, but in a great voice work and terrific music, I think set it apart. So I enjoyed Trolls, and the audience I saw it was, which by the way, was packed at the theater we went to on Saturday. Everybody in the theater seemed to have a good time too. My parents loved it too. So I'm recommending it. And again, the music's fantastic. So there you go. All right. Okay. Yeah. Eric, why don't you tell us about, Doctor Strange?
Okay, well, this is the latest entry into the Marvel canon, and stars Benedict Cumberbatch as Dr. Stephen Strange, who is a brilliant neurosurgeon, who is very arrogant neurosurgeon, know-it-all, photographic memory, that kind of thing. And he gets into a car accident and gets severe nerve damage in his hands. His hands have to be almost completely rebuilt. And lacking the power within himself to put his hands back together so he can continue living out his luxurious life as he's grown accustomed to, he ends up finding that there is a place in Nepal where someone might be able to restore his powers, so to speak. And that person being the Ancient One, played by Tilda Swinton, who is one of a group of sorcerers, I guess you would say, who are actually responsible for guarding the sanctums or the various dimensions of the Earth, and they're able to basically leap through time, fold space, bend time and space, all kinds of things. Very, very fancy magicians these folks are. And so we go through a lengthy training process where Doctor Strange learns all these techniques, and it turns out that there's a villain. Of course, there's always a villain. This one played by Mads Mikkelsen, who is, of course, a former student of the Ancient One, and he's looking to tap into the various dimensions to basically get to a place in time where immortality exists. And so he'll do whatever he needs to do, including breaking the natural laws of the sorcerers and their rules and things to basically, you know, find the place and time where everyone can live forever. Okay. So, I mean, I don't even know what I just said, frankly. And Doctor Strange, while being part of the Marvel Universe, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of Marvel people who will correct me on a lot of things that I may have just said. This is one of the best examples I have yet in the sort of the offense against people who talk about visual storytelling, because this is a movie that is very, very, very dependent on its quote-unquote trippy visuals to tell its story, and it, in doing so and showing the various powers that the sorcerers have and their ability to leap from one place to the other and their ways of bending the natural universe and all these things. So we get a lot of sequences that, frankly, I've seen in Robert Zemeckis and Christopher Nolan films. And when I was watching them, like, okay, this is all you got? What do you got in the story? And there's really not much to the story. There's not much to the hero. There's not much to the villain. There's not really much in the way of excitement. Just because you can pull off some sort of Inception-ish way of turning the world upside down and being able to go walk up buildings and run across buildings and turn buildings on their head and all these kind of things, doesn't mean you're actually forwarding anything or creating something fun out of it. You know, Christopher Nolan's Inception gets a lot of flack sometimes for the sheer amount of exposition that is in the first hour of that movie, when in fact, without that exposition, you wouldn't really understand anything that's going on in the back half of that movie. And this movie suffers as a result of that. And frankly, you don't care enough when these things start happening, and there's not enough of it to really care about to begin with. This movie is just dumb. It's boring. I was falling asleep during it. I like Benedict Cumberbatch, but it seems to me he's sort of doing Sherlock here without the charisma or the writing to sort of back up his intelligence. None of the supporting characters, with the exception of Tilda Swinton, really make any kind of impression. In fact, the most charismatic character in the entire movie is a cloak. And I was, by the time this movie was over and the credits started rolling, I got up and left immediately. I don't even knew or care if there was a pre-credit sequence or post-credit sequence or whatever they tack onto it. I just wanted to be done with this thing.
Wow. All right, well, we got to take a break. Eric clearly did not like Doctor Strange, and we'll find out what Colin thought of it, and I'll give you my review as well. We are reviewing the new movies, and we will continue to do so right after we take this break on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower, here till 5 o'clock, and we're reviewing the movies. Eric Childress, Colin Suter from efilmcritic.com and RogerEbert.com join me every Monday for the new movie reviews, and then Eric and I talk about the box office, which we'll do in a little bit. Before the break, Eric told us about Doctor Strange and gave us his review, and he didn't like it at all. And so let's find out what Colin thought of it. Go ahead, Colin.
Yeah, I really don't like when movies have the word strange in the title, but they don't give you anything strange or weird or interesting. I knew nothing about this superhero going in. I have no idea who Doctor Strange was before this film came out. So this was more of the same. This was why I'm sick of Marvel movies. It's because of movies like this. It shouldn't have been called Doctor Strange. It should have been called Dr. Tony Stark, because that's all Cumberbatch is doing. And that's all this character really is. He's a neurosurgeon version of Tony Stark, the rich, arrogant guy who, you know, has a smart aleck quip for every situation. And now he's a superhero. I mean, I agree with everything Eric said, pretty much. I think I actually may have had a little bit more of a better time. I mean, in spite of that, I did think Cumberbatch was kind of fun to watch, and Tilda Swinton is too. So I laughed a few times during this movie, but when it was over, like Eric, I kind of just wanted to leave. I didn't really care about anything. When Eric started talking about the description, he started getting around to the villain. I was like, oh yeah, there is a villain in this thing. Who was that again? Who? I don't remember. You know, I mean, I saw this a couple weeks ago, but I mean, seriously, like, my memory of this villain is like, this is like the most bland, most uninteresting villain in a Marvel movie I've seen in a long time. And that's really saying something for a Marvel movie, because that's been a recurring problem. So yeah, this is a movie that just, you know, just because you're bending buildings doesn't mean you're making a mind-bending film. And, you know, we've seen this before. It's kind of trippy and kind of cool to see on a big screen, but it doesn't really give me much in terms of something to latch onto for, you know, dramatic tension or anything like that. Especially since Doctor Strange learns all this stuff pretty quickly and becomes a pro pretty quickly at it. You know, they're kind of really rushing through the origin story, which on one hand is okay. On the other hand, it's like, well, we know he's the chosen one. you know, I don't know. This is just, you know, to me, it's just another Marvel movie. Not as bad as a few of them, but certainly, you know, not nearly as good as, you know, Captain America from earlier this year or, you know, the Avengers. But, yeah, this is just kind of more of the same.
I guess I'm in the minority because I liked it. I thought it was good. I had a good time. I thought Cumberbatch was terrific. And I mean, I agree with you. I think, but, you know, a lot of the superheroes are cut from the same cloth, though. You know what I mean? I mean, Colin, you said it's like Tony Stark, yeah. But Tony Stark is like other, you know, Tony Stark is like Batman. You know, I mean, it's just, you know, there's an archetype for whatever comic book hero there is, and there's just, you know, there are variations on it, and you're absolutely right. That's exactly what this is. It's not like we've never seen a character like this before. That Tilda Swinton was terrific and having a good time. Now, I don't, again, like you guys, I don't know anything about the comic. I've never read it. Dan, Shagru, you know the comic, right? You know the character. Are you a fan
a little
of the
bit.
Character?
He's not my favorite, but I, you know, he's part of the pantheon for sure.
Yeah. My friend Scott Oaken, Doctor Strange is one of his favorite characters. He loved the movie. Now, I don't know whether that's going to have an impact on how you feel about it. Again, I walked in not knowing anything. And I thought it was cool. I thought the effects were really great. Now, again, you can't do this bending the world thing and not think of Inception. Immediately, that's what you're going to think of. There's just no question about it. And Inception is a much better and smarter movie than this one. No question about it. But I think the effects here are cool. I think, you know, there's a very strong cast of supporting characters in this movie, and they all don't have a ton to do. But, you know, I mean, there's some. I thought Mads Mikkelsen was good as the villain. Of course, I love that guy anyway. So, you know, but I thought, you know, Scott Derrickson directed it. He is mostly a horror director, but he did do one sci-fi horrible remake of The Day the Earth Stood Still. And that and stylistically, it has more in common with that movie than the horror work that he does, because he's made a few decent horror films. But it you know, it doesn't have the kind of joy that Avengers has. It doesn't have that kind of sense of humor. There are moments in the movie that are funny, but the overall tone of this movie is a lot sort of darker than you would find in the Avengers movies, which to me are bright and very funny all the way through. But I liked it. I had a good time. I saw it in the IMAX, which I think is a great place to see it. It had, I thought, really cool effects and some interesting stuff, and I thought it was kind of exciting. So I like Doctor Strange. I know I'm alone on that.
You're not alone. Oh. Actually, Colin and I are very much in the minority.
Oh, really?
On this one. Although I think there are a lot of people that knows the writer who used to be a film critic. Wink, wink.
Ah.
But yeah, you know how I call Joe Johnson Three Star Johnson?
Yeah.
You know? Well, this is Star and a Half Derrickson.
You haven't liked anything that Derrickson has directed?
No. In fact, I've looked back, I've given every one of his films a star and a half.
Wow. Okay. All right. I like the Law and Order Exorcist movie. The episode of Law and Order
with Exorcism of Emily Rose.
Yeah, I like that movie a lot.
Yeah. It has one of the more insulting endings I've seen.
Oh, I like that movie. Even though it was an episode of Law and Order with, you know, a possession in the middle of it. His remake of what were some of the other ones that he did? I liked
Sinister.
I didn't like Sinister. Oh, the one with Eric Bana.
Deliver Us from Evil.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, maybe
you're and a half Derrickson.
Yeah. All right. Well, okay. Well, that's Doctor Strange, and it's playing everywhere. And we'll talk about how much money it made over the weekend and all that stuff coming up. But we'll take a break here, okay? You guys hang on.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we got the news coming up here. And after the news, we will come back and talk about Hacksaw Ridge, which is Mel Gibson's new movie, and we will go down the box office results for you for the weekend as well. All right, we'll take a quick break here. News is coming up next. Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. And here till 5 a.m., Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5 and Steve Cochran at 6 a.m. for your morning drive. Our phone number and text number is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. You can check us out on Twitter at Nick D Show. But the best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page. So like us right now, facebook.com/Nick D Show. All right, we are reviewing the new movies. We got one more movie to review, and then we'll talk box office as well. And the movie that we've got left to review is Mel Gibson's new film, as a director, Mel Gibson's new film, Hacksaw Ridge. So Okay. Colin, tell us about Hacksaw Ridge.
Mel Gibson's latest directorial film, his fifth, I believe, and tells a true story of a soldier named Desmond Doss, and he's played by Andrew Garfield. And he was a guy who had some horrific experiences in his youth that made him into a pacifist for life. This story takes place during World War II, and Doss is seeing everyone he knows enlisting in to fight overseas, and he feels like he should be doing his patriotic duty and doing the same, except that he's a pacifist and will not touch a gun or a rifle. So, you know, his role during heavy combat duty would be as a medic. He wants to help the wounded and help save lives, but he's, you know, still got to go through basic training. And needless to say, being a pacifist doesn't go over very well with the other members of his platoon or his drill sergeant, played by Vince Vaughn. But they eventually see that he does have the courage of his convictions, and he does have the courage to be court-martialed and maybe even jailed because of them. Hugo Weaving plays his dad. Rachel Griffiths plays his mom. And Teresa Palmer plays his love interest and eventual wife. And she's also a nurse. So, you know, this is a Mel Gibson movie, and you know if you've seen his other directorial films, Passion of the Christ, Apocalypto, Braveheart, you know that you're not going to get subtlety here. You're going to get a very visceral experience. And once this movie hits the battlefield in Okinawa, it is as visceral an experience you're likely to have in a movie this year. And it is rightfully being compared to the opening scene of Saving Private Ryan. The context is different, but the effect is definitely the same. It is unbelievably, horrifically, graphically violent. And it's really hard to watch at times. But I think it's necessary to put it in context of what this guy accomplished by going into battle and not firing a single shot, but accomplishing an amazing thing. This is a really fascinating story to tell. And I think that it's one of the another reason why it works is because of Andrew Garfield. This feels like a role he was born to play. This is, you know, he is very in the first half of the film, you know, very charming. He's boyish and, you know, likable. And, you know, I think he's good at getting the audience to relate to him and to like him and to really root for him in this. But then in the second half, you know, he's got to bring that to the battlefield with him. And I think he does a remarkable job of maintaining that character in a battlefield sequence where it is just, it's so hard to watch, but for him to be the audience through line, I think it's really effective. I do think in the latter half of the film, or the last section of the film, I think Gibson goes a little overboard with the sentimentality of it at the end. I gets a little too angelic for my liking. I kind of wish he'd pulled back a little bit or offered something a little more, a little more complexity to the character. But on the whole, I think this is a really effective war movie it should be seen on the big screen, but know going in that, you know, it's going to be tough to watch. But I do recommend it.
All right. Eric.
Yeah, I really love this movie. And to follow up with what Colin was sort of saying there, yes, the final image of the film is really kind of on the nose. But I think at that point, you reach a point where you're so with this story and you're so with this guy that it's kind of impossible not to feel a little bit something, even if you think that the final image is a bit heavy-handed. But I'll say this about that and leading up to that, and that one of the things that Colin didn't touch upon too much is that this is a guy that was very deeply rooted in his faith and his religious upbringing, there's a lot of religious imagery in the film. And while this is a guy that in a movie that sort of wears that that mantra on its sleeve, it's a little bit more on the inside of its sleeve. But I think what separates a movie like this that wants to tell a story about a guy who has a deeply religious upbringing, and that eventually led him to be the sort of the conscientious objector that he eventually was, is that this is a movie, as opposed to, garbage like the God's Not Dead movies. This is a movie that shows you how a person of faith can utilize that through action and not preaching and not trying to recruit people, but to show people the way, so to speak. And what he does in the battlefield is nothing less than extraordinary. In fact, I've heard Mel Gibson actually give interviews saying that there are things in the movie that he couldn't show because people wouldn't believe some of the things that he did, particularly in the final instances. He's likely to be criticized in some circles for the amount of violence. He's certainly never been subtle with violence in the past and been criticized for it. But, I think, it's incredibly appropriate. This is not an episode of The Walking Dead we're talking about here. This is war. This is, comparing it to the opening scene of Saving Private Ryan is, again, appropriate. And I think, everything Colin said about Andrew Garfield is almost like the unsung hero. We're going to be focused on the direction of the film, and Mel Gibson's storytelling abilities are impeccable. He's really got a fantastic sense of how to tell a story like this. And Andrew Garfield is really terrific in this movie. I think Hugo Weaving is great in this movie. This movie, had its hooks in me so much that I didn't realize until after I got home that I would have been watching Sam Worthington for 2 hours in this movie. Yeah. I didn't even realize. I'm like, this guy's pretty good. Who is this? Vince Vaughn is good in this movie. I think that this is a remarkable accomplishment. I think it's if you want to rank the Gibson achievements, I'd put this just behind Braveheart. I think it's really, it's one of the best movies that I've seen all year.
Okay. All right. Hang on, guys. I'll give you my thoughts on it when we come back from break. That, again, is Hacksaw Ridge, which is Mel Gibson's new film as a director, Andrew Garfield, Sam Worthington, and so on and so forth. And I'll tell you what I thought of it coming up right after we take a break here. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Tribune Tower. It's Monday morning. That means my dad will call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We're going to talk about some food-related items and stories that we have here, and we'll get talking about food. We also have the Blackhawks Express to play back for you later on as well. Right now, though, we're in the middle of movie reviews. Eric Childress, Colin Suter, and I are talking about the movies. And before the break, Eric and Colin both gave a positive review to Hacksaw Ridge, which is director Mel Gibson's latest movie. And I'm with you guys. I think it's great. I will agree with Colin, though, on I think he goes a little too far at the end. And it didn't sit as well with me. But there is a lot of amazing stuff in this movie, and it is brutal. It is one of the most brutal war films I've ever seen, and with good reason. It's very effective in that way. Be prepared. And again, if you're familiar with Mel Gibson's work, with the exception of The Man with the Screwed Up Face, he's not known for being subtle or holding back the violence. But I think in every case, he does it very effectively. I know that Mel Gibson's got this reputation, and justifiably so, for being like a lunatic, and you can kind of see that in his movie. I mean, he's a very, this is like the visions that this guy has as a filmmaker, I think, are very revealing about the guy's personality in a very fascinating kind of a way. But this is a beautifully made film all the way through. And Andrew Garfield, here's the thing about Andrew Garfield. I was talking to Dan about this last week. When he's not Spider-Man, the guy's great.
Yep.
I mean, the guy's a tremendous actor, except when he's Spider-Man.
And this, Social Network, 99 Homes.
Yeah, 99 Homes, Social Network. You got Never Let Me Go.
He
was tremendous in that movie, and he's great in this. This is like the best performance he's ever given. And that says a lot, considering how good he's been in other films. But this is just a remarkable piece of work on his part. And you're right. He's the guy that you follow through this whole thing. And there are jaw-dropping moments in this movie. The Okinawa battle sequences are just, I mean, you know, you guys both mentioned the opening of Saving Private Ryan. It's just like that, except it's even more violent, if you can believe that. So prepare yourself for a very, very intense, very visceral experience. But I think it pays off. Like I said, I thought the last part of the film went a little too far and was a little too heavy-handed. And again, Mel Gibson never known for his subtlety in any way. But overall, this is a really great war film. And if you're in the mood for that kind of thing, if you want to see something very moving and something very powerful, but yet really, really sometimes hard to watch, Hacksaw Ridge is pretty great stuff. And Mel Gibson, man, he might be nuts, but the guy can direct. I mean, he might be a lunatic, you know, but the man is a filmmaker. The man
That's
is a filmmaker.
That's South Park, you know. You say what you will about Mel Gibson, but the SOB, no story structure.
That's exactly right. So, all right. Well, those are the movies for this week. Now, Eric, you're hosting a screening Wednesday night.
I am.
Yeah, tell everybody about it.
Yes, at Elk Grove Cinema, our monthly event that we do, I'm hosting a screening of Mel Brooks's Young Frankenstein. We wanted to do some of the tributes.
Another crazy Mel.
Yes, exactly. Another crazy Mel.
Yeah.
We wanted to do a tribute to Gene Wilder, and I think we've played Blazing Saddles there a couple times already. So people have been asking us to do Young Frankenstein, so here it is. And so come see the movie on the big screen, and I'll be doing a presentation afterwards, and we'll have a discussion, and we're going to have some special prizes to give out as well.
All right, and that's Wednesday, November 9th,
mm-hmm.
And it's at the Elk Grove Cinema. How much is it to get in?
$6. Matinee price is $6.
$6.
It's 7 o'clock.
All right. Starts at 7 o'clock, November 9th, Young Frankenstein, Elk Grove Cinema for $6. I screened it at my film club a couple of years ago.
Yeah, and it killed.
It's so funny. It's so mm-hmm. funny. And, of course, you know, it's got sedative, which is my favorite moment in that entire movie. It's my favorite moment in the entire movie. And, you know, you got to mention the fantastic... Awesome cameo by Gene Hackman.
Yes.
Just one of the greatest.
One of the greatest cameos ever.
Yeah. Exactly right. All right. And you know how we ended up in the movie? Because he knew Gene Wilder from Bonnie and Clyde.
Right.
And said, hey, I'd love to be in the, is there some place I can sneak in here? You know? And mm-hmm. he's like, all right, play the blind guy. Yeah, go ahead. So, anyway. All right, so that's going to be Wednesday. And what do we got next week, movie-wise?
We have Arrival.
Mm-hmm.
It's hitting theaters. We have Jeff Nichols' new film, Loving.
Yes.
Yeah, and Almost Christmas.
Almost Christmas, yep. And also, Naomi Watts horror movie.
Oh yeah, Shut-In.
Shut-In with the kid.
Yeah,
kid from Room. The kid from Room is in it.
Is he?
Yeah, he's the main kid in it. The kid.
Oh,
yeah.
I didn't even know.
Yeah, he's the main kid.
I will go see that. Then.
I think it's odd that he's now starring in a movie called Shut-In after after he was in Room. Is that going to be his career path? Is that, I don't know.
Yeah, maybe.
They're not screening it for critics.
They're not? That's too bad.
I mean, no.
Yeah. I mean, I saw the trailer for it. I think it looks pretty cool, man. You know? So, anyway, all right.
Every time I see the trailer in the theater with an audience, the reveal of the title gets a laugh. There's something about the movie called Shut-In that makes people chuckle a little bit. And I'm kind of with them.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I don't know. It looks pretty cool. And the kid from Room is awesome. And Naomi Watts is great. I don't know. I can't remember who. Do you know who directed it?
I do not.
Wait a minute. Hold on. I can find out. I have a computer. All right. Here we go.
Sigourney Weaver from Copycat.
It is Farron Blackburn.
Oh.
Yeah. Good old Farron. It's also got it also has Oliver Platt in it too, but wait, who is Farron Blackburn? Real quick, let's find out who this guy is.
TV guy.
He's a TV guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he's not Scott Derrickson, so it's an improvement.
Right. He always directed some episodes of Luther. He's a British TV guy. He's done.
Oh, okay.
He's done Doctor Who's. He's done Luther. He's done The Interceptor. He did Daredevil. He did episodes of Daredevil.
Oh, okay.
All right. So there you go. I mean, the new Daredevil.
Obviously. Right. Yes.
So okay. All right. Well, listen, Colin. Thanks, man. We'll talk to you next week.
Go vote, everybody.
All right. Yes, everybody's going to vote. We better. All right. All right, Colin. Thanks. Eric, hang on, okay?
Uh-huh.
All right. We'll take a break, and we'll come back, and Eric will tell us all about the we'll talk all about the box office coming up. But we got the news next, and then we'll come back and talk box office right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Studios, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. And we're here till 5. All righty then. Yeah. Welcome back. 312-981-7200 is your phone for talk and text. My dad's going to be calling in a little bit to tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we'll hear our latest Blackhawks Express. The Cubs. The Hawks have won 6 straight now. And we will hear the Fantastic Express from last night's game. And we're going to talk food, too, some crazy food items and crazy food stories to talk about. But we want to wrap up the movie segment with our box office. Eric Childress joins me to take apart the box office. And you write a box office piece that appears at movies.com, right?
Correct, yes.
Okay, so let's talk about it. Number one, Doctor Strange, $84.9 million. Is that low or is that high?
Well, it seems... you could answer that both ways. It seems low compared to, you know, your Captain Americas and your Avengers and even Guardians of the Galaxy. It's lower than those numbers. But, you know, we talked a couple of weeks ago about how these tracking companies and whatnot seem to be now shifting gears and maybe lowballing things to sort of give the appearance of these greater numbers. The tracking numbers on Doctor Strange were they put it at 55 to 75 million, which is kind of a wide berth to begin with.
$20 million in between. Yeah,
exactly. Like we got a suspect. He's between the ages of 18 and 83. So those numbers seem very suspect to begin with. And, you know, if this movie had been in the low 70s, I don't think anyone would have batted an eye. But it seemed to me, I said that I thought that this thing could reach, you know, low to mid 80s. It seemed kind of natural. I mean, if the Thor sequel did like $85 million in this exact same spot a few years ago.
Right.
And the question now is going to be whether or not this movie is going to, you know, get newbies on board like, you know, you, or is it going to, you know, sort of not, you know, get the sort of the you know, the casual Marvel people. You know, I mean, the fans may like it or they may not. But Thor the Dark World started with about this much and only made $206 million.
Mm.
I say only. But Doctor Strange, it's killing overseas as well. I mean, this was not a cheap production. It was a $165 million budget, which in many cases would seem to spell trouble. But it's made almost $85 million in the U.S. in 3 days, and it's already made $240 million overseas.
Wow.
Yeah, so this movie is already made back essentially its production budget. Now it just has to make back its prints and advertising costs.
Wow. Well, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Number two is Trolls, $45.6 million. That's good, right?
I think that's a really good number for this movie. I mean, it's been sort of a glut for the animated or just the family marketplace in general right now. I don't think we've really had anything of consequence since Storks came out.
Mm.
And, you know, I think it's a lot easier for parents to explain where Trolls come from than, baby.
Right.
But, you know, but this one did really well. Now, again, you know, is it going to, you know, break out to be some sort of $200 million hit? Probably not. But, you know, anywhere between like 140, 160 million, I'm sure they'll be very happy with a number like that.
I'll tell you what, I guarantee you the soundtrack's going to sell. I guarantee you. I mean, I don't know if that's not going to help the box office numbers at all. But, you know, when it was over, I wanted the soundtrack.
Well, and it's funny because that's something that I talked about on my podcast with Sergio a few weeks ago, the idea about how you don't see that so much anymore. You don't see the, you know, where, you know, you're like the big hit song from a movie
mm-hmm.
and something like that. I mean, with a soundtrack here, a soundtrack there, but you don't really see that the way you sort of used to, especially back in like the 80s, where a song would drive people
yeah.
to the movie or yeah. vice versa and that kind of thing.
Well, you know, the music business is so different now, and the way people,
yeah, absolutely.
And the way people receive their music and how they listen to it is totally different than it was
mm-hmm.
before.
Heck, we, you know, the two of us had to figure out who Solange was last night.
Yeah, I had no idea who she was.
Right.
But the thing about the Trolls soundtrack is that it's just that, you know, that Justin Timberlake dance, dance, dance song is in there.
Yeah, yeah.
But which is a hit, obviously, and popular mm-hmm. with the kids and stuff. But it's weird because it's all sort of like 80s throwback music that they go
okay.
to. Because, like, at one point, Zooey Deschanel sings Hello by Lionel Richie.
Ah.
Like I mentioned, there's a Cyndi Lauper, True Colors is in there, mm-hmm. September by Earth, Wind & Fire. So it's got, you know, it's got that one centerpiece song, you know, the Justin
yeah.
Timberlake song, which is, you know, very elaborately animated and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But almost all of the other music cues are from the past. And I think that's really interesting that Timberlake chose those songs.
Well, see, I mean, Happy Feet did that a little bit.
Yeah, they did. Yeah,
did they not?
Yeah,
mm-hmm. yeah. So, I mean, so maybe Trolls is, you know, registering well with people who have member berries.
Yeah, I think so. All right, so that's 45.6 million for Trolls, and then number three was Hacksaw Ridge with 14.7. That's not very huge numbers.
It's not very huge, but I think it's exactly what they hoped for. You know, I mean, the one thing we didn't really bring up during the Hacksaw Ridge review was, you know, all, you know, whatever controversy Mel Gibson brings with him for, you know, things he's done in his past.
Right.
And, you know, you want to talk about people, you know, you know, you could actually look at the movie as, you know, a movie about a, you know, someone who, a conscientious objector. That's what a lot of people are when it comes to Mel Gibson,
mm-hmm.
you know, and, you know, filmmakers of this type. And, you know, so that's, you know, you can look at the movie on another level there. But, you know, I think that a mid teens opening for this is they're kind of like wiping their brow a little bit, because I think if this thing would have come down to like 10, 11 million, then it would have shown a little bit that people were sort of avoiding the movie. With an opening like this, it's probably enough people to sort of go like, hey, neighbor, this is actually a really good movie. Maybe, you know, forget about what you've heard about Mel in the past. He's a really good filmmaker, and you might really like this movie.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, it's not going to set the world on fire. And, you know, this is probably not going to build up enough steam for Oscar talk and whatnot. Maybe some technical things
yeah.
and whatnot.
Yeah.
But, you know, if they can find a way to, you know, get this movie to like 50 million. Gibson's films have done very well overseas. This might still have a chance to turn a profit.
Okay. Talk about profit. Tyler Perry's Boo, A Medea Christmas, or Halloween.
Yeah.
$7.8 million, and it's up to about $65
million. Yeah. By Tuesday, it'll be the second highest grossing movie he's directed. And as we predicted, and it doesn't take much to predict this, but Lionsgate has greenlit two more Tyler Perry movies, including one with Madea.
Okay. Well, yeah, they don't cost much, though.
No, but they were costing enough that the dwindling profits on them basically stopped them from making them
yeah.
for a while. You know, this 2.5-year drought is not just because Tyler Perry was tired of making movies. It's because people were tired of paying for them.
Yeah.
And it's not turning to profit. And now this one has. Again, it's not going to be a gigantic profit. I mean, these movies make nothing. All the profit is in the U.S.
Yeah, right.
These movies make nothing overseas. If they make $1 million, that's a boon.
Yeah.
We're going to get two more, and this one's definitely in profit.
Fantastic. Number five is Inferno, $6.2 million. $26 million, man. This is a tank.
In the U.S.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
But overseas, it's done almost $160
million. Wow.
So it's not far, it's like $40 million away from reaching profit for Sony. So, you know, they cut the budget in half. They figured, like, we'll make one more of these things. Maybe we can squeeze a couple million out of it. But this is dead. This franchise is dead now.
Yeah, absolutely. Number six is The Accountant, $5.9 million, $70.8 million total. Now, what is this doing overseas? Has it opened overseas?
Yeah, it's really, the last couple of weeks, it's doubled and tripled its numbers overseas. A few weeks ago, it was like 10.3 million. Last week, it was like over 21 million. This week, it's over 38. So it's steadily making its climb to where it needs to be in a profit. I mean, clearly $70 million, you know, for a Ben Affleck starring vehicle in the U.S. when he's not playing Batman or Daredevil or in some other big tentpole movie, Jack Ryan, is definitely a success in that way. And hopefully, you know, when we see Live by Night, when that comes out, that'll, yeah, you know, people will start flocking to that as well.
Jack Reacher, Never Go Back. Wow. 5.5 million, 49 million.
Yeah.
Is this how low on the list of Tom Cruise movies is this one?
Well, I mean, it has to reach 58 million to pass Far and Away. But I don't know.
Also directed by Ron Howard.
That's right. Yes. Yeah, it brings down Tom Hanks and Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
Just like Tyler Perry. But I don't know if this movie is going to make the $63 million that Risky Business did back in 1983.
Yeah. I mean, back in 1983, $63 million was a smash. A
lot of money.
That's a lot of money.
Lot of money back then. But this is looking like the least successful Tom Cruise movie since Eyes Wide Shut.
Wow. Okay. Eyes Wide Shut. Box office bonanza written all over that movie.
You're right.
And then the Ouija. The Origin of Evil, 3.9 million, bringing its total up to 31.2 million. This has got to be considered a success, right?
Yeah, it's a hit.
Okay.
Yeah, Blumhouse just makes a cheap movie. A lot of people like it, you know, which is cool.
I liked it.
Yeah, you liked it. Yeah. Colin liked it. Yeah. A lot of people did, and you know, that's their staple. They make cheap movies, and some of them are good, some of them aren't.
Right.
And you make a couple million, and you move on to the next one.
All right. All right. Cool. And everybody can see you on Thursday mornings on the WYCC.
Yeah, Business First AM, 5 a.m. on Thursday mornings with Angela Miles. Yeah, so set your DVRs for that if you're not up.
Yeah, if you can listen to this show and then turn on the TV right afterwards.
That's right.
And then you talk about box office and money and the movies and the money.
That's correct.
All right, cool. All right, we will talk to you next week, Eric.
Yep.
And we'll do the movies and we'll do the box office again. Thanks, buddy.
Sounds good.
All
thanks,
right, there
man.
You go. Take care. There's Eric Childress, and he and Colin Suter will be back again next Monday for the Monday Morning Movie Reviews.